Welcome to Statewide, reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. On the way this hour, the George Floyd verdict restored a sense of hope in the justice system for many black and brown people, including those who have lost loved ones to police violence. We'll hear from a Chicago woman. Illinois leaders have called for ethics changes in the wake of a major scandal, but will it get done? We'll have a report. There's a fight brewing between Illinois car dealers and an electric vehicle manufacturer wanting to cut out the middleman and sell directly to consumers. More on that story. And we'll look back to the summer of 1998. Baseball had a home run race that captured the attention of the country, only for the sport to be embroiled soon after in a steroid controversy.
Sports cloud our vision because we love these teams and these players in extraordinary ways, and we can't quite see them for what they are sometimes.
More on a podcast that looks back at that time. That and more ahead on Statewide. This is Statewide, reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. This hour, we'll hear about a push for ethics changes in the wake of a bribery scandal involving a major utility in Illinois. The state has a law requiring the teaching of black history in schools, but how will it work? And it's been a difficult year for students and also for educators. What lessons have they learned? That and more ahead on Statewide. For those who've lost loved ones to police violence, the conviction of Minneapolis officer Derek Chauvin for the killing of George Floyd brings hope, but also pain and worry. Arewa Karen Winters is the great-aunt of Pierre Laurie. The 16-year-old was fatally shot by Chicago police in 2016. She spoke with reporter Patrick Smith this week, just a few moments after the verdict was announced. Winters says she woke up early Tuesday morning, pleading with God for a guilty verdict.
About 10, 15 minutes ago, I was like, my stomach was like in knots. I never really have much faith in our judicial system, just because I know so many families that, you know, just did not receive justice for their loved ones, where, you know, the officers are still on the floors, the officers have been promoted, the officers still in our communities. But I am very happy in this moment, happy that justice was truly served. And I have a restored hope in the judicial system that every now and again, it works for the people. So
I wanted to ask about that. You know, you were the great aunt of Pierre Lowry, who was killed by Chicago police. And when I spoke with you a few weeks ago during this trial, you said that you and a lot of people who lost loved ones to police violence were watching this as almost as a symbol for all of you, as somebody who was maybe standing in for loved ones. So when you think about that, how does this feel considering the way you were viewing this trial?
Yes, for families who've been impacted, it's triggering, it's re-traumatizing. But I hope for all those families that have had trials and felt they did not get justice, that we always say when one wins, we all win. And so for all of us who have lost loved ones, we should all be celebrating, because, you know, it's a strike against the system. You know, I'm very proud of the Minnesota Police Department, because I've never seen Chicago Police Department get on the stand and say that one of their own was wrong. So I'm very proud of the Minnesota Police Department for, like, look, hey, this is not what we trained. This is not what he should have did. And I hope we set a new precedent, because it is the way that it should be. Because we always talk about bad apples. Well, get rid of your bad apples, and we won't have to keep going through the same thing over and over again.
You talked about a precedent. Do you believe that this verdict can have an impact here in Chicago or across the country?
Maybe across the country. I'm not so sure about Chicago. Chicago is I don't know why, but it's hard. It's like it's so hard. And even now, you know, it's like they're still failing at the consent decree, and they keep saying, well, this is our first time, and we understand that. But it's like they're still not meeting their marks. And for me, they're making excuses. So I don't know about Chicago.
So obviously there was the recent killing here in Chicago of the 13-year-old boy, Adam Toledo. There have also been a lot of protests here in Chicago, both after that shooting, but you know, all last summer. Do you feel like there's more attention on this issue of violence by police officers now than in the past?
The first one that, you know, I think that I could remember witnessing was, you know, the Rodney King. And that was one where we all thought, like, they ass is going to jail. And, you know, it didn't happen. And so it's nothing new. I think what is new is cell phones and, you know, social media, and that there is an unearthing. It's not going to be this political system in Chicago or our police department that affects change. It is going to be these activists and these organizers and these families that have been impacted that keep fighting and keep unearthing and keep getting in their faces, like, you know, not this time.
That's Arewa Karen Winters. She's the great aunt of Pierre Laurie, who was shot and killed by Chicago police in 2016. Illinois has new landmark legislation that aims to dismantle systemic racism in education. One part of the new law requires expanded Black history lessons in schools. That's a change that's celebrated by Black teachers and parents, but some are concerned about how it will play out in practice. Lee Gaines introduces us to one parent who's already made it her mission to teach the Black history she says is missing in schools.
Brennan Hightower and her family have a favorite history game.
So let's say I flip over two and I get Jesse Owens. So we have a match. You go to your book of heroes.
The goal of the game is to match historic Black figures and events.
I get to Jesse Owens and it gives me a little bit of information about him. It said Jesse Owens was acknowledged as an American hero after winning 4 gold medals in track and field events in the 1936 Olympics in Berlin.
Hightower, who is Black, lives with her family in Danville in East Central Illinois. She bought the game years ago, but still plays it with her sons, who are now 10 and 15. Hightower says the game inspired her to buy more educational materials about Black history.
Because a lot of what's being taught in the school is American or European. They're not getting a lot of the Black history or the African-American history.
Earlier this year, the Black Caucus in Illinois' General Assembly helped to pass legislation to tackle systemic racism in education. The new law requires that K-12 schools teach students about Black history dating back thousands of years. Curriculum must include African history, the reasons for slavery, and the American Civil Rights Movement. One of the lawmakers working on this issue is State Representative LaShawn Ford.
I believe that when history was written, it was written with only one group at the table, white men. And so I think that this is not an attack on white men. This is just getting it right, realizing that it's from one lens.
Ford is a member of the state legislature's Black Caucus. He's a Democrat who represents portions of Chicago's west side and western suburbs. He's also a former teacher. Ford says most Black history in schools begins with slavery.
But the truth is, we were born in a country where we were kings and queens, and we actually made major contributions to our country. And then we were uprooted, taken away from a culture, and our history was erased.
Ford says the law demands that students get a more accurate and inclusive version of Black history. Even though he's been working on this for years, Ford says the killings of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor placed a spotlight on racial inequities and created an opportunity to pass the legislation. The Illinois State Board of Education says the new standards won't take effect until the 2022-23 school year. And some schools in Illinois are already teaching the kind of history that lawmakers like Ford want to see. Trayvon Parnell teaches African American history, an elective course, at Central High School in Champaign.
We get an entire semester to really break down what exactly, why are Black people here, and what enfranchisement has looked like over the last, you know, almost 170 years.
Parnell, who is Black, applauds the new law, but he also worries about how it will come across in the classroom if teachers don't make an effort.
There's certainly a much more robust way of discussing the serious complexities of structural racism and the story of Black people. And there is really a wrong way to do it.
But he's happy the law sets a new standard, and he hopes students 10 years from now will have a much more accurate understanding of history. Brennan Hightower, the parent in Danville, is pleased by the change, but she says she'll continue to teach Black history at home.
Because I don't know how it's going to be taught. You know, I don't know who's going to be teaching it. And change is not easy for everyone.
Hightower says if Black history lessons honor and respect the legacy, it will benefit all students. And that's something she's looking forward to. I'm Lee Gaines, Illinois Newsroom.
Just across the Mississippi River at the northwest tip of Illinois, the Dubuque Museum of Art is hosting a temporary exhibition of a timely new mural downtown. Herb Trix brings us the details.
The museum is hosting Dana Harrison's I Am a Man mural at the corner of Bluff and 8th Streets in downtown Dubuque. Two stories tall, it's being created on the west side of an empty building. The mural in Dubuque is inspired by a famous photo taken on April 8, 1968, by photojournalist Bob Edelman at the Memorial March in Memphis, Tennessee, for Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., who'd been assassinated just days before. Gary Stoppelman, executive director of the Dubuque Art Museum, says Dr. King was planning to lead the I Am a Man March in Memphis, supporting a sanitation worker strike that had begun in February.
So on April 3, King delivers his I've Been to the Mountaintop speech, which is a call for unity, call for peace, and it's prophetic. He says the choice is between nonviolence and nonexistence, and the next day he was murdered.
On April 8, the march originally in support of the sanitation workers becomes the I Am a Man march and a memorial for Dr. King, with 42,000 people marching in total silence behind his widow, Coretta Scott King.
Well, there are a lot of reasons. We chose that individual photo specifically for its humanity, for its expression, its simple expression, and its resonance today by focusing on one individual. There was some discussion between the artists about what would work best, and they felt strongly that focusing on a moment in time where an individual felt it was important to hold a sign declaring his humanity was particularly resonant to this moment today, and to the fact that this is cyclical and ongoing. And our hope, of course, is that as this photo has inspired people that to continue Dr. King's message forward, that our work will inspire people to do the same as well. We're just trying to continue the conversation.
Dana Harrison is a native of Fort Dodge, Iowa, who has created murals across the state, including Des Moines. Fellow Iowa graffiti writer Asphate will work with Harrison on this mural. The intersection of Bluff and 8th is where the Dubuque Museum of Art was originally established in 1874 and is now the home of the Telegraph Herald offices. Across the street, where today there is a parking lot, was once the African Methodist Episcopal Church. In addition, I Am a Man is a fitting image for the museum campus. It sits adjacent to Washington Square Park, a popular location in Dubuque, historically and today, where local citizens gather, march, and protest. Stoppelman says while the building remains, a mural is a reminder of struggles of the past and how far we have yet to go. Because it's temporary, the image calls on us to carry its message forward. The museum hosted a free community conversation on April 11th between the artist and museum curator Stacy Gage Peterson, which was a learning experience for all.
It was pretty extraordinary. I think it was extraordinary on a couple of levels. It was the first moment where we were able to gather as a community since I've been here, and really since before I came here, in the past year. So that gave it some significance just to begin with, right? That it was inspiration for the community to gather in a way that we haven't in a long time.
Stoppelman says the mural is an example of how the museum has worked the past year to engage the community in new ways. And it's important that the mural, which may be up for 2 years, will be temporary, according to the artist.
This work has to be temporary. There's something important about the fact that history continues to repeat itself and that nothing is fixed and permanent, and that we need to continue to learn and push ourselves forward, that requires this work, he said, to be temporary. So that was the artist himself speaking.
Stoppelman thinks public art like this can bring people together and express common hopes and dreams.
I hope, speaking for myself only, that it sparks conversation. It sparks conversation around what is the role of art in a civic dialogue, what is the role of a museum in civic dialogue at a very minimum, and that encourages us to think about what does it mean when for the past 50 years and many more, people have felt the need to literally hold a sign saying, I'm a human.
To learn more about the museum, visit dbqart.org. And for Jonathan Turner, I'm Herb Trix.
Many colleges and universities are now making their plans for the fall semester, among them Western Illinois University, which says it will return to business as usual in a few months. Rich Egger explains.
Due to the pandemic, Western finished last school year with online classes only. The university held a mix of online and in-person classes this school year. But the plan is to return to the traditional on-campus experience in the fall. That's according to an email University President Guiyu Huang sent to the campus community Wednesday. It remains to be seen whether COVID-19 vaccines will be required for students returning to in-person classes. This is the administration's Joe Roseleib during a town hall forum on Tuesday.
We're going to take our cues from the state of Illinois, IBHE and IDPH, and hopefully sooner than later.
The administration also says its return to work plans are subject to change given the ever-changing rules and guidelines associated with the pandemic. The union representing faculty says the administration must negotiate with it to establish the working conditions for returning to in-person classes. Rich Egger reporting.
A wildlife rescue group in Kewaunee says that Illinois bald eagles are dying and lead poisoning is to blame. Tamara Yarger is president of a wildlife rescue organization in Kewaunee. The group has cared for 3 poisoned eagles in recent weeks. She says lead poisoning originates with hunters using lead ammunition. Field dress from their kills is left and consumed by other animals, which can become sickened if they ingest the lead. She says that when bald eagles are found with lead poisoning, they usually are too sick to save.
They all had classic lead poisoning symptoms, very lethargic. One had her head was completely twisted around and she was looking up at the sky. One, you could just walk up to him and pick him up. And the other one had literally just fallen out of a tree and just sat there.
Yarger says hunters should use lead-free ammunition to avoid inadvertently poisoning bald eagles or other animals. You're listening to Statewide. Stay with us. Welcome back to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Still on the way, we'll tell you about a growing dispute between the state's car dealers and an electric vehicle manufacturer. And later, a sports writer recalls an exciting summer of baseball in 1998 and the scandal that followed. Still ahead on Statewide. The bribery scheme perpetrated by the utility Commonwealth Edison is one of the more shocking scandals in Illinois history. And that's saying something in a state that has seen plenty of political corruption. ComEd admitted it spent years trying to bribe the man who was once Illinois' most powerful politician, former House Speaker Michael Madigan. That led to Madigan's downfall and vows from state lawmakers to clean things up by passing ethics reforms. But as Dave McKinney with member station WBEZ reports, those changes are slow going.
The bombshell dropped last summer. ComEd admitted it gave no work contracts and jobs to Madigan Associates in order to win favorable legislation in Springfield. After that, Republicans got to work, not on reining in ComEd, but on getting rid of Madigan.
Representative Madigan engaged in conduct which is unbecoming to a legislator or which constitutes a breach of public trust.
House Minority Leader Jim Durkin tried to get Madigan thrown out of the House of Representatives. His effort was blocked by Madigan's own Democrats, who later would abandon Madigan themselves because of the lobbying scandal appointing a new House Speaker in January. But now, with Madigan out of the picture, legislators face a new question. What to do with ComEd?
It's really a shame that we have to babysit the utilities in this way.
Democratic State Representative Ann Williams represents Chicago's North Side in Springfield. She's been working on a massive energy bill that says ComEd's lobbying practices can't be ignored.
Unfortunately, ComEd has shown us that they were willing to really make a mockery of the legislative process.
So Williams' bill would do away with automatic rate increases for ComEd customers based on a preset formula, a law that was passed as the bribery scheme was going on. It also would require a log for each time legislators ask a favor of ComEd, like getting a job for a supporter, though that log would not be public. And her bill would create a regulatory czar to watchdog utilities and would bar them from billing ratepayers for criminal defense lawyers. Williams says the ethics component of her bill is still a work in progress.
The reality is that we are going to be cleaning up the mess created by the ComEd activities for some time to come.
Advocates say the bill could go a lot farther in holding utility companies accountable so this doesn't happen again.
Do I think that this is good? I would say it's a start.
Bob Gallo runs Illinois AARP, which is a major consumer advocate on utility issues.
I don't think that it really answers or addresses the problem and how it started.
But it's not clear Williams' bill has all the support it needs to pass. A rival package has been introduced with the support of some unions. It contains a provision that would require ComEd to rebate $200 million to ratepayers. That's the same penalty the company paid to settle the federal bribery case against it last summer. The new House Speaker, Emmanuel Chris Welch, is a co-sponsor of Williams' legislation. A spokesman says Welch wants to address what he calls shortfalls identified by the ComEd scandal, but he hasn't been involved in either measure. Meanwhile, Democratic Governor J.B. Pritzker is expected to outline a new ethics package shortly. The governor's point person on utility legislation, Deputy Governor Christian Mitchell, tells WBEZ he expects ethics reforms aimed at ComEd to top his list.
Any energy legislation that he's going to find worthy of support is going to need to lead with ethics reform.
In a statement, ComEd says it embraces strong ethical standards, but points out some of the ideas being kicked around now in Springfield were adopted by the company last year. There's still more than a month for legislators to figure out a compromise. But the possibility remains that despite all of its legal problems and its tarnished image, ComEd still has enough influence to get what it wants out of Springfield. Dave McKinney, WBEZ News.
Illinois mayors are again asking state lawmakers to give more income tax revenue to local governments, money the mayors say the state owes them. Hannah Meisel has this report.
Pritzker's proposed budget would mean another cut to local government's share of state income taxes. A coalition of mayors, including Chicago's, say that's unacceptable. Here's Highland Park Mayor Nancy Rotering.
It's unbelievable that the state has this legacy of continually sweeping funds inappropriately for uses they weren't originally intended for. Those were never the state's funds to use to fill their gaps to begin with.
Up until a decade ago, Illinois sent 10% of state income tax revenue to local governments, a policy that dates back to a deal brokered to establish an income tax in 1969. But since 2011, the amount of money sent to cities around the state has fluctuated at much lower levels. And today, local governments get nowhere near the amount of state income tax revenues they relied on for decades. I'm Hannah Meisel.
Illinois car dealers are suing electric automaker Rivian over its plans to sell vehicles directly to consumers. Christine Hatfield reports it's the latest chapter in a nationwide debate over the options consumers have to buy cars.
Many states, including Illinois, have laws to restrict new car sales to independent dealers. University of Michigan law professor Daniel Crane says those are a product of the days the big three manufacturers, Ford, General Motors, and Chrysler, dominated car sales.
They had disproportionate bargaining power vis-a-vis their franchise dealers. You had just the big three. Dealers were mostly mom-and-pop organizations. And the argument the dealers made was that the big three were taking unfair advantage of them.
But dealerships aren't necessarily mom-and-pop businesses anymore. According to the National Automobile Dealers Association, the average new car dealer in Illinois made close to $49 million in sales last year, and that's before taking services and parts into account. Crane says the dealer model in place now doesn't work for electric automakers like Tesla and Rivian because dealers make much of their profits servicing cars. Crane says service on electric vehicles works in a very different way.
There are no oil changes. There are fewer moving parts. There are no tune-ups. Lots of the servicing or updates is done over the air by the manufacturer. And so this model of make the money on service just does not work for the dealers.
The controversy over direct-to-consumer sales started nearly a decade ago when Tesla announced plans to sell vehicles through company-owned stores and service centers. Eventually, Tesla reached a compromise with the Illinois Secretary of State and the auto dealers. That deal allowed Tesla to have up to 13 dealer licenses. The Secretary of State's office assured dealers at the time it wouldn't grant licenses to other manufacturers, but Rivian's entrance onto the scene has forced state agencies to take another look at the laws in place. Last July, an informal opinion from the Secretary of State's office said state law doesn't explicitly require manufacturers to go through independent dealers to sell their vehicles. Pete Sander is president of the Illinois Automobile Dealers Association, which filed the lawsuit last month against Rivian. Sander says the Secretary of State has been inconsistent.
We need to get some type of a determination on how to move forward. I think the manufacturers need that, the dealers need that, and the consumers need that, as well as for their own protections.
Sanders says dealers have said they're ready and willing to sell Rivian's cars, and he says the dealers protect consumers and bring jobs to their communities.
That's the importance of having a franchise dealer system out there to protect not only consumers, but just to make sure that the vehicles are handled in a correct manner.
Marina Lau is a professor of law at Seton Hall University in New Jersey who specializes in antitrust law. She formerly served as the director of the Office of Policy Planning at the Federal Trade Commission. She says the auto dealer's argument doesn't make sense.
If you add a mandatory layer of cost between the manufacturer and the consumer, it probably will increase consumer prices, or at least I'm not sure that you can make an argument that it would reduce consumer prices.
Lau says it'd be better if manufacturers and customers alike can decide what approach works best.
The fundamental principle of our laws, our competition laws, is that consumers should decide not only where they buy their cars, but how they buy it, right? And consumers may well benefit from being able to buy the cars directly from the manufacturers.
As for the lawsuit against Rivian, Lau says the outcome will depend on how judges read the law.
If the statute is interpreted as saying that an auto manufacturer that uses the franchise system may only sell through its franchise dealers, then the law wouldn't apply to a Tesla or to a Rivian.
Rivian would not comment for this story. I'm Christine Hatfield.
Well, this week marked another Earth Day, and most people don't think about taking care of themselves on that day, but two Northern Illinois farm executives say we are extensions of our home, and focusing on our health can in turn save the environment. Yvonne Booz explains.
This once-a-year celebration is a time when most people reflect on taking care of the Earth. Joy Kaufman is the founder and executive director of Farm Stew International. She has a master's in public health and says her love for nutrition started as a little girl.
I actually became a vegetarian just because I loved animals when I was 9. And my family thought this was just going to be this little, you know, fad for a 9-year-old, but I stuck with it.
As an adult, she says she realizes how preparing these creatures for ingestion can impact the Earth's resources,
both in water and land used to grow those resources, and then also the production of greenhouse gases from those animals that contributes to these climate crises that we're facing.
She says if people would give up eating meat once a week, it would contribute to preserving the planet. Carla Stolzfus Detweiler is the executive director of Hungry Rural Farm. She says we are what we eat.
That's just one little thinking about how our health is so intimately connected with the health of the soil that feeds the plants, that feed the animals, then that we eat. It directly affects our health.
Detweiler explains that her organization seeks the well-being of all.
What that phrase means to me is that we're wanting to demonstrate the interconnectedness of people with every part of creation.
Kaufman says Farm Stew is an acronym for some of the things we should do to take care of ourselves. She explains a few principles.
So the letters stand for farming, which was our foundation, as I mentioned, attitude, changing to a positive mental attitude, and also just, you know, forgiveness.
Both Kaufman and Detweiler say their organizations focus on teaching so others can live more abundantly while taking care of the earth. Detweiler shares some of the things her nonprofit focuses on to accomplish this.
Last year, there weren't many public events on the farm, but we hope to have a few coming up soon. So inviting people to come to the farm to learn about soil health, to learn about composting, to learn about food insecurity.
Another similarity between the two organizations is that they are faith-based. Kaufman says she believes the creation story in the Bible.
But we start saying, okay, we were made in a garden by a God who planted that garden, and then he told us to tend and keep that garden. So gardening or farming, which is the core farms view, is our first core, is a divine work. It's a holy work. It's a work that is blessed and was designed to sustain you.
Detweiler says people can start their health journey by starting their own garden.
I just think there's so much joy in planting seeds and watching that miracle of this dead little fleck growing into a plant that gives you food. Just starting small with a couple of tomatoes and some herbs is a great way to start.
Farming is not just about activity. Growing things requires time and patience. This is a period of downtime. Detweiler says this phenomenon is a principle we can use for better health. She says quiet time can bring calmness, renewal, and a chance for reflection. I'm Yvonne Booz.
Schools have been figuring out pandemic education for more than a year now, and even though it's not over, Peter Medlin asked a few education leaders to reflect on the past year and say what they've learned.
Steve Wilder has no idea what normal looks like in Sycamore. He started as superintendent for Sycamore Schools in July 2020. He spent his spring frantically guiding his outgoing district through the first wave of the crisis while also trying to transition to his new position.
There were times that I felt really helpless because those questions were coming and I didn't have the answers that people wanted that I wanted to be able to share with them.
He's not alone. For everyone, students and administrators alike, every day early in the pandemic was met with new state guidance and a new series of crystal ball type questions where no one knew the answers. Amboy Superintendent Joshua Nichols says education leaders got a courtesy call from Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker the first time schools had to shut down, but most of the time he had no idea guidance was changing until everyone else did.
I would sometimes find out about things, like if I was busy in the afternoon, from parents and other employees.
Education was reinvented on the fly in real time while districts scrambled to secure supplies to keep their kids safe and tech so they could learn at home. Some schools bought tons of plastic face shields, thinking they'd be essential, only to find out a week later they wouldn't work. Out in rural Amboy, Nichols spent federal emergency funds on improving their Wi-Fi, but download speeds still weren't adequate for e-learning.
It's just not good service, and Wi-Fi is terrible. That's where it is. We did put some Wi-Fi access point. We used CARES dollars for that outside of the building so that if people needed to, they could pull up and get it.
Without reliable internet, they focused on coming back in person in the fall, and they've been there ever since. Nichols says it was more feasible as a smaller district, although they had adaptive pauses and a few COVID cases in their middle school even recently. Sycamore swung from hybrid in-person to remote learning through the year as case counts fluctuated. At one point, they had over 300 students quarantined. Now, students can learn in-person up to 4 days a week. Wilder says they're still wondering what exactly next year will look like.
I still think there's going to be a need for some sort of remote option. You know, the question is how many students, you know, are going to need to take advantage of that.
Nichols is asking himself the same questions about this generation-defining moment. How has COVID fundamentally changed education?
When you start thinking about like high school kids, do we need them every single day in the building?
He's also been searching for silver linings from what has been a year of trauma for his students. What were their blind spots that the pandemic shined a light on?
We're talking about feeding kids through summer and all this stuff, but this is the first time we've ever had this conversation. And there are very few districts that did that. And so it's like, is that okay that we've never done that? Or that kind of bothers me a little bit. You know, I mean, because we have the means to do it and we haven't done it.
The pandemic has also pushed schools like Sycamore to invest in social-emotional resources. Social workers have pushed mindfulness techniques and self-care to students, even if it can be hard not to make it feel forced or awkward.
They were kind of left to learn independently, and, you know, they dealt with things in their own personal life. They lost family members, they lost friends, and we focus so much, I think, on the other stuff that sometimes it's easy to lose sight of how difficult things have been for each of us.
And for all the talk of learning loss, some students did struggle with remote learning, but they agree it's not as dire as some predicted. Even last spring when they were, as one educator described it, putting the plane together as it was in the air, Nichols says,
education did not stop. It kept going the entire time.
Some familiar activities are beginning to return. Graduation ceremonies will go on, and even some pandemic-altered proms may take place. And they're going to have to keep looking back on how the pandemic has impacted and still impacts their students. But now, at least, education leaders might have some answers when the next set of questions roll in. I'm Peter Medlin.
There is more of Statewide on the way, so stay with us. You're listening to Statewide. Well, up next, sports writer Joan Neeson talked with Sarah Finsky about Neeson's new podcast. It's called Crushed, and it goes back to the summer of 1998 when she was 10 years old, and it involves baseball.
When you love a sport the way I loved baseball, you know exactly when you got hooked. The year, the game, maybe even the exact play. You remember it in slow motion, the light, the colors, the sounds. In my story, that moment came on September 8th, 1998, a Tuesday night in my hometown, St. Louis.
A gorgeous night for baseball. Very hot.
My favorite player, Mark McGwire, was one home run away from breaking the most sacred record in sports.
I'm wondering if this is the at-bat that Mark McGwire moves one place in front of Roger Maris.
I was at a friend's house that night, and we were glued to the TV. I was sitting on a toy rocking horse, which looked like something from a carousel. White and pink, with a gold pole I held onto while I swayed back and forth, praying for a home run. And then...
down the left field line! Is it enough? Gone! There it is! 62!
I jumped off the horse, threw my arms in the air. The horse rocked forward, then back, and the pole smacked me square in the mouth. I tasted something chalky. A sliver of my front tooth had chipped off. But I couldn't have cared less.
And you will always know where you were at 8:18 p.m. Central Time, September 8th, 1998.
Joan Neeson is a former Sports Illustrated staff writer, and her podcast isn't just about falling in love with baseball. It's about falling out of it, about how the 1998 home run race that thrilled her as a child was later revealed to be a steroid-fueled scandal. Joan's podcast is called Crushed, and it's a production of PRX and Religion of Sports. Joan, welcome.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
So that moment of Mark McGwire's home run, it must be seared in your brain and your mouth. Do you still have that chipped tooth?
I do, you know, and I don't want to oversell it. It's not something that you really would notice unless you were looking for it. It's very, very tiny. But I do.
And you can feel it in there. I mean, every time you feel it, do you go back to that date, that September?
You know, I think a lot about baseball as a sports writer, and that was the moment that hooked me with the sport and probably led to me, you know, doing the job I've been doing for the past decade. So yeah, I do think about it a lot.
So that was the moment. You were already 10 at that point, maybe came later to the game than some young St. Louisans. Did you grow up in a baseball family?
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, I was always a Cardinals fan as a kid, and in the way that any, you know, kid can be. You don't know that much about what's going on, but you go to games and you love it. Yeah, and the podcast talks a little bit about my family and how my dad especially just really instilled this love of baseball in me and my brother.
So take us back to 1998, this pivotal year for you and also for baseball's record book. Were the Cardinals any good that year?
Not really, which is, I know, sort of unfamiliar territory over the past, you know, couple of decades, but this was kind of right before they got good, right before sort of those Albert Pujols, Jim Edmonds, Scott Rolen years. And that year, I have a math brain, despite being a journalist, which I know is sort of uncommon in
our
field. It
is unusual.
But, yeah, so I loved all the math of that summer. And one of my favorite things that I loved looking at was how far under 500 the Cardinals were and if they could possibly just be a winning team. Which I think they were a 500 team by the end of the year, but just barely. They were not a playoff team.
So this wouldn't have been such a big year. Maybe wouldn't have been the year that hooked you if not for this home run race. So remind us of what was all going on at that point, because there was a lot. It wasn't even just Mark McGwire chasing this record.
Yeah, and I think that was a big part of it, that it wasn't just Mark McGwire. Sammy Sosa in Chicago was also sort of hot on his heels for the whole summer. At the beginning of the year, Ken Griffey Jr., in Seattle was also sort of in the mix, but he fell off, and it was really Mark and Sammy down the stretch. And so there was that Cardinals Cubs rivalry that everyone was, you know, I think everyone enjoys to, you know, loves to hate. And
that played into it. And baseball had just come off a strike in 94-95 and was really struggling to kind of reestablish itself after all that labor unrest. I think for the first time, the sentiment had sort of swung against players. Players were viewed as somewhat greedy, I think, by the general public. And because they had, you know, denied fans baseball for a little while. And I think that summer really helped, you know, bring baseball back and in some ways save baseball after a really disastrous labor negotiation.
So this wasn't just media hype. This was something that attendance was up. People were way into this.
Very much so. Yeah. Attendance dipped after the strike and then it just sort of kept skyrocketing. 98, 99, 2000, 2001, you know, just attendance records. And yeah, it made a lot of people a lot of money.
So this all goes back to the excitement of home runs. And in your podcast, you explored just what makes home runs so special.
In football, we remember the quarterbacks with cannons. We watch tennis and we're awed by fast serves. In hockey, slap shots. In basketball, dunks. But in the pantheon of power, I don't think anything tops the home run. Frank Cusumano agrees.
I mean, there's an infatuation with brute strength and raw power. When you see an exit velocity of 120 miles an hour catching up with a 98 mile an hour fastball, I mean, that's the essence of masculinity.
And that's Frank Cusumano. He's the sports director of KSDK and a radio host at KFNS. You're a female fan of baseball, Joan. Do you think he's right that this is all tied up in sort of the masculine ethos?
That's a great question. And I think there is an element of that sort of macho masculine culture that plays into the home run, especially back then when, you know, it hadn't been too long since sort of the, you know, late 80s, early 90s, everything was very, you know, pumped up. And I think this sort of is an outgrowth of that. But to me, yeah, I'm a woman and I've always loved baseball. I've always loved home runs. I think it would be so cool to hit a home run, which is not something I'm physically capable of. And maybe there's an admiration of that too, where it's like, the power and the masculinity, I don't know that I'm admirable or I'm admiring masculinity necessarily, but the power of it all is really intoxicating.
Mm-hmm. And it's just such an exciting moment. The fact that, you know, it can literally change a game with one stroke. I mean, it's not just showing off. Like, this is a game changer.
Totally, totally. And I think that's why this has been such a big deal in baseball for decades and decades.
So this record, up to the point of this 1998 series, this was held by Roger Maris, who I feel like a lot of people today have forgotten about Roger Maris, but he had set this 37 years before. You interviewed for your podcast, you interviewed Roger Maris Jr. about how he felt about this single season home run record being broken.
You never want to see your dad's record fall. I mean, obviously, it was to me, I think it's one of the greatest records in sports. So you clearly don't want that to happen. But you also realize that records are made to be broken. And now dad said that once. He said it 1,000 times that, you know, just like he broke Ruth's record, and, you know, someday somebody might break his record.
And that is Roger Maris Jr. He was interviewed for the new podcast Crushed, which is a production of PRX and Religion of Sports. And we're talking today to the host of that podcast. That's Joan Neeson, St. Louis native. Joan, we know now that that record was broken with the aid of anabolic steroids. Did that change how Roger Maris Jr. felt about it? Did that seem like cheating to him, that's what broke his father's record?
You know, I think it did. I think that was a really interesting time for their family because his dad had faced a lot of adversity while breaking the record, because the record prior to that was held by Babe Ruth, mm-hmm. and a lot of people did not want to see Babe Ruth's record fall. So I think the home run record was always a pretty fraught thing for the Maris family, even though it was this wonderful achievement that their father had accomplished. But I think that Roger Maris Jr., he says in the podcast, he watched that summer and in the back of his mind was thinking, look at these guys. They look like they're juicing. And he, as a former, you know, athlete, not he'd never played in the majors, but he was an athletic guy who had spent time in gyms, and he knew that anabolic steroids were kind of everywhere. And so he says in the podcast, you know, he doesn't want to spoil the fun. He didn't want to feel like make everyone think that he was just a sore loser. So he didn't say anything at the time, he and his family, but I think it was a tough moment to watch that and sort of suspect, ooh, what's going on here?
It's interesting. We asked our listeners for their memories of this season, and Brad wrote, quote, "I remember looking at those guys at the time and thinking, that's not baseball, that's steroids, and being disgusted that everybody was cheering for cheaters. In some ways, was this kind of an open secret at the time, and it was just the 10-year-olds who didn't know what was really up?"
You know, as the former 10-year-old, I didn't have a clue what was up. That said, I think it was and it wasn't. I think that Brad, obviously, was able to look at that through a pretty objective lens. I don't think a lot of people do that with sports. I think that sports cloud our vision because we love these teams and these players in really, you know, extraordinary ways, and we can't quite see them for what they are sometimes. So people weren't really quite yet talking about steroids in 1998, unless they were, I would say, particularly plugged into that scene. So yeah, it was, the 10-year-olds were certainly blind to it, but I think a lot of adults were too.
We also heard from Twitter user iHumble. He says what he will remember most about the 1998 home run race is that, quote, "Major League Baseball knew good and damn well that Maguire and Sosa were on the juice, but they did nothing because the home run chase brought people back to baseball after they had a strike." That's that strike you mentioned. Attendance was down. They brought it back up. Did baseball have a good incentive to look the other way?
Absolutely. They absolutely did. This, like I said earlier, this made them a lot of money. And, you know, I don't think there was any sort of evidence that Major League Baseball had at the moment that Mark McGwire or Sammy Sosa or Barry Bonds or any of those guys were using steroids. I don't think they had something in their arsenal that they were hiding. I think they were choosing to not find that evidence. They weren't testing. Steroids were illegal. Anabolic steroids were illegal. The government had made them illegal, but baseball did not have an anti-steroid policy. There was no mechanism for testing or punishment. The commissioner of baseball at the time, Bud Selig, made several statements sort of after the fact that he had to go talk to his pharmacist about what any of these things were, and everybody was trying to remain in the dark.
That's interesting. So your podcast gets into both what happened that season and all the fallout from that season. I want to encourage people to listen to this podcast, Crushed. It's a great listen. I think there's two episodes out now of what's going to be a 7-episode series. But Joan, I'm curious about for you, did when these revelations finally came out and you were no longer just that baseball-loving 10-year-old, did that change your love affair with baseball?
So it probably changed it a bit. I think it made me a bit more skeptical. I think there's always in the back of my mind, if you get excited about something, you hope it's not tainted because something was tainted. But I still, I mean, I became a sports writer in large part because I really fell in love with baseball and sports at a young age. And I still love baseball. I still love watching baseball. And the Cardinals gave me a lot of other things as a kid to cheer for post-McGwire. You know, you go right into the Albert Pujols years and the World Series. And that was, you know, 2006 was my first World Series of my lifetime. I was born in 1987. So right after a great run, I didn't see any of that. And so, it changed things for sure. And I guess the example that I like to give is as the fallout of the steroid era continued and there were congressional hearings in 2005 about this, and those hearings sparked the Mitchell Report, which was an investigation into baseball's steroid use, and that eventually came out and named a bunch of players for using. And I remember being a teenager when that happened and being very concerned that Albert Pujols' name was going to be in the Mitchell Report. It wasn't. He was to no one's knowledge juicing, but I remember thinking, oh my gosh, what if? What if another sort of moment I loved in baseball is ruined? And I think that's the legacy of the steroid era to me.
So what made you want to revisit that era to go so in-depth over 7 episodes as opposed to, say, the Pujols era? Everything's happy.
You know, I think it's a story in baseball that isn't talked about. And I ran into a lot of walls while reporting this because people still do not want to talk about steroids in baseball. There's a lot of, I think, self-delusion going on among people involved and a lot of sort of projected delusion onto others. So that was a big part of it. Just what could I learn? And the other thing that I was really interested in with all of this is right now we're talking about Mark McGwire and people talk about him. They talk about Sammy Sosa. They talk about Barry Bonds. They talk about these celebrity players who, you know, some have admitted to using steroids. Others have not. They probably did. They probably all did. They are like a percentage of a percentage of a percentage of the total players in Major League Baseball who were playing during the steroid era. And I was very curious what that experience of playing in the 90s and early 2000s was like for, you know, the average fringe player who's trying to make the big leagues and also trying to string together enough contracts to, you know, put dinner on the table for his family because minor leaguers are paid a pittance. And how did all of this sort of trickle down to the people we don't talk about today? And that was what really hooked me on the idea.
Joan Neeson is a sports writer from St. Louis. Her podcast, Crushed, looks back at baseball's famous home run race of 1998 and the steroid scandal that would soon follow. She talked with Sarah Finsky. You can find a link to the podcast at our website at statewideshow.com. That's all the time we have for this week Statewide. We'll be back next time, and we'll have more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. Be sure to join us. If you missed any of this week's episode or past shows, you can find them at statewideshow.com. Our podcast is available through the NPR One app. I'm Sean Crawford, and Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois, with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.